Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio, celebrating its 10th year. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Well, the president did the thing he said he wasn't going to do. Margaret Love is an attorney at the law office of Margaret Love. Boy, that's convenient. She specializes in executive clemency and restoration of rights, sentencing and corrections policy, and legal and government ethics. She also served as a U.S. pardon attorney in the 1990s, and she's here to talk about the Hunter Biden pardon. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Margaret, this was, you know, it shows you how quickly news moves. This was the biggest story in the world until maybe a day later when all this other stuff happened.
So, oh, how about 15 minutes ago?
Exactly. But we really appreciate you being on, especially given your expertise in this area. So as Ryan mentioned, you know, we all know now that Joe Biden, that maybe the big news wasn't so much that he issued this pardon, but I think the sweeping nature of it caught a lot of people by surprise, including, I think, yourself, because this was a full and unconditional pardon. It really insulates Hunter Biden from not just crimes that he could have committed, but anything over the past decade. So do you think this was maybe the most sweeping pardon ever? And if so, why do you think he used this language, aside from the obvious fact that he wants to protect his son?
Sure. It's very unusual. Certainly in the last 100 years, there's only been one pardon that comes close, and that was President Ford's pardon to Richard Nixon, which also pardoned him over a 5-year period of his presidency for anything he might be charged with. And as you say, what was particularly unusual about Hunter's pardon was not so much pardoning him for the cases that he had been charged and convicted of, although not yet sentenced, but extending that to anything that he might be charged with, going back to 2014. So it was very surprising to me, the whole idea of preemptive pardons, in other words, sort of insulating people from prosecution in the future, is something that really has never been the practice in the federal system ever since the Civil War. And the only analogs other than Nixon that one can point to in terms of the breadth of these pardons were pardons that were given frequently in sort of in terms of amnesties at the end of the Civil War and during Reconstruction. And that was a really public purpose to restore the country after a terrible Civil War. Nixon's pardon has come to be seen by many as having the same public purpose of kind of restoring the country after a period of turmoil. I'm not sure whether Hunter Biden's pardon fits that pattern.
Some Republicans are arguing that if Biden pardons himself, he'd be guilty of obstruction of justice. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't understand the argument, frankly. I mean, you can obstruct justice in a lot of ways. I suppose they could say anytime the president reaches into the middle of a criminal case and grants clemency or pardon, he's, quote, obstructing justice in the sense that he's not letting justice. But I mean, many of the pardons, frankly, that President Trump did were in this category of sort of walking into the middle of a criminal case and pardoning it right out from under. And that was, he used the pardon in a very unusual way also. So I first of all, I mean, it assumes that the president can do that. I should have said that first, which I'm not sure he can. I think it's kind of off the mark, frankly.
What are your thoughts, Margaret, on Trump's comments over the weekend, which, to be fair, he said in the past, including on the campaign trail, that he is still open to pardoning some of the January 6th convicted, the people who were convicted for January 6th. You know, he didn't give exactly a clear answer on the Sunday show. I think it was Meet the Press, but he certainly said that he's open to that concept.
Sure. Well, it's not the first time I've heard that. He said that, gosh, he's been saying that through the campaign, I think. That's very interesting. I'm not sure how that would happen. And you're mentioning that he said some of those who were convicted in connection with January 6th. I'm not sure how he would pick and choose. And if he does pick and choose, rather than simply saying, issuing, for example, a big proclamation saying anybody who was convicted of anything in connection with what happened at the Capitol on January 6th is hereby pardoned, and then sort of throwing it to some, I guess, the Justice Department to sort it out, to see who's covered and what they're pardoned for and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it would be a very technical sort of a expertise. I think there are 1,500 odd cases that were prosecuted. I think there's some that still have not been prosecuted and that have been investigated. I'm sure he'll do it. It'll be very interesting to see exactly what he does. And I have no doubt that he can do whatever he wants to do.
Herbert, what do you think are the chances of Biden pardoning Trump? Because there's been a lot of conversation around that being a step that could be a very meaningful step towards healing the country. What do you think the chances are of that happening?
Pardoning him of what, the two federal cases?
Yes.
Well, I mean, they have been, I thought, dismantled. Why is there any need to do that?
Well, there was discussion about pardoning him of any offenses that he may have committed during the last few years. So I don't think it's just the federal cases, but I think that it's more of a symbolic move that they're talking about being a meaningful step, especially against the backdrop of him having pardoned his own son.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't think he'll do it. And second of all, I think it would be very hard to sort of describe what a pardon like that would look like, whether it would only be the cases that have already been brought against him or anything that might be brought. But I mean, gosh, you know, he's coming into office. He's going to be in charge of the justice system. So he gets to say whether somebody brings charges against him or not. So I would think that would be a major sort of deterrent of. And anyway, as I said, I doubt very much that President Biden will do that. He has a bunch of things on his plate right now, on his clemency plate, including the capital cases in the federal system, those who are on death row, who are awaiting, at this point, many of them have exhausted their judicial remedies and are awaiting a word to be executed. Biden had a moratorium on execution. And I think many feel that, gosh, you know, the last time during Trump's first administration, he ordered the execution of a number of people on federal death row. So there's that group. And then, of course, if you look at the hundreds and hundreds of cases of ordinary people who have applied for pardon and sentence commutation, there's been a backlog going back to the Clinton administration of cases that have applied in the ordinary course and expected to be pardoned. I mean, I have lots of clients there who have been waiting for, I have clients that applied in more than 10 years ago. So, I mean, I hope that he will do some of those, what we used to call, or I didn't call them there, but my boss, when he was deputy, Bill Barr used to call them the little people. And I hope he'll do a lot of little people pardons because, I mean, those are the people that have expected a regular operation of the president's mercy. And I hope that he will get back to that.
Marcus, speaking of your former job, we only have about a minute, so I apologize for that. But you know, you headed up the U.S. Pardon Office for 7 years in I think, parts of two administrations, right?
That's right.
Bush 1 and Clinton. You know, this is not the first time we've talked about a president pardoning a relative, of course, famously on his way out of office, Bill Clinton pardoned his brother, Roger. So maybe you could tell us, what was the most difficult part of your job in your role as pardon attorney?
Well, the most difficult part of my job was persuading the Justice Department that they should serve the president as opposed to their own parochial interests. That was a problem that I had because I dealt with prosecutors and they really had a stranglehold on the regular pardon process. Now, I hope that eventually we will get back to a regular operation of a policy, of a process that ordinary people can apply through. So that was the most difficult part of my job and one that I continue to hope going forward in the future we can return to.
Fun couple months coming up in the pardon world, that's for sure. Margaret Love, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're most welcome. It's a pleasure.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubble and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. The U.S. Supreme Court appears to suggest it will uphold laws that ban gender-affirming treatments for minors. The High Court is considering a case that could impact dozens of states. Go back to D.C. We've got a very Eastern time zone heavy guest list today. Professor David Cole of Georgetown Law teaches constitutional law, national security, and criminal justice. He's former ACLU legal director, and he's represented plaintiffs in this case. Also a correspondent for The Nation. Thanks for coming on with us, Professor Cole.
Thanks for having me.
So, Professor, last week the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in this Cremeni case in which the federal government sued the state of Tennessee on equal protection grounds over a Tennessee law that bans gender-affirming medical treatments for transgender adolescents. The district court had ruled in the government's favor, and that decision was overturned by the Sixth Circuit. Can you tell us more about this case?
Yeah, so absolutely. I, with the ACLU, represent the families of the transgender youth who sought this care, including Ryan Rowe, a young a man who was identified female at birth, but was a very, you know, happy kid until identifying as a boy for a long time, until he faced puberty. His voice started dropping or rising, actually, and he was throwing up every morning before going to school. He wouldn't speak in class. And finally, after therapy and meeting with his doctors and consulting with his parents, they decided to take gender-affirming care, puberty blockers and hormones. And he is now a happy person. He's found his voice. And the question really is, should Tennessee be able to stop a family like Ryan Rose from achieving the from obtaining the medical treatment that their doctor determined is medically necessary, that they've decided to take on for you know, with their child's consent, because it opposes people acting in ways that are not consistent with Tennessee's views of how people who are assigned a particular sex at birth should act for the rest of their lives.
And Tennessee's position was that this application was on based on medical purpose, not sex, right? Explain the differences you had there.
Yeah. So the law on its face says you cannot receive medical treatment in a way that will allow you to live or identify in a manner inconsistent with your sex determined at birth. That's what the law says. And so if you are seeking medical treatment to be consistent with your sex assigned at birth, you can get it. Inconsistent with your sex, you can't. So our contention is that is a sex-based classification. If Tennessee said you cannot dress inconsistent with your sex, if they said you cannot pursue a career inconsistent with your sex, if they said you cannot wear cosmetics in a way that is inconsistent with your sex, we would all recognize that is a sex-based line. Tennessee says, no, it's not a sex-based line, even though the law on its face says it is, because it's really about medical treatment for gender dysphoria.
So, Professor, a key issue before the court is the appropriate standard of review of the law. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that is?
Absolutely. So if the law discriminates either on the basis of sex or transgender status, our argument is it should be subject to what the court calls heightened scrutiny, where the government really has to come forward and justify why it's treating people differently based on sex or based on transgender status. Historically, sex-based classifications were accepted on a very deferential, rational basis review. And so, for example, the Supreme Court upheld laws that banned women from being lawyers, that banned women from working in bars on the ground that they, you know, it was too tough for them. They were fit. And so the court eventually said, no, we've got to subject laws that draw lines based on sex to heightened scrutiny, more skeptical scrutiny, to make sure that they are based on real differences between men and women and not based on stereotypes about how men and women should act, should be, et cetera. That's our contention here. This law, because it draws a line based on sex on its face, it doesn't mean it's invalid necessarily. It does mean Tennessee has to come forward and show that it has a good reason for this prohibition. Tennessee argues, no. This is just about medical treatment. It's not about sex, even though it says it's about sex on the face of it. And therefore, we should only have to satisfy something called rational basis review, the most deferential standard the court applies to things like social and economic legislation. And if that's true, then not only could Tennessee bar gender-affirming care for minors, but it could bar gender-affirming care for adults. And the United States Congress could bar gender-affirming care for anybody. So it's a very extreme position that Tennessee has taken. Our view is simply when you draw a line based on sex, you've got to put up or shut up. You've got to justify it by showing that it's not based on stereotypes. And here, at the end of the day, it is a stereotype to say that people who are assigned female at birth should live and identify as a woman for the rest of their lives. It's true for the vast majority of us that we live consistent with the sex that we were assigned at birth, but it's not true for 1.5 million Americans. So it's a stereotype. By definition, it's a generalization that applies to most people, but does not apply to a significant number. And the Supreme Court has generally said you cannot base laws based on stereotypes about how men and women should act and be.
Professor, not surprisingly, the arguments seem to follow partisan lines. Chief Justice Roberts said that I think he questioned whether the court was in the best position, expertise-wise, to evaluate these decisions medically or whether they should leave it up to the legislature. Justice Sotomayor contended that any medical treatment carries a risk. So given your prior experience, which is extensive at the Supreme Court, what did you take away from the way the arguments went?
So it's true. The conservative justices, or five of the conservative justices, seemed to express some skepticism, and in particular skepticism about their ability, the court's ability, to assess how a particular medical treatment should be regulated. That's generally something we leave to the medical profession and the states, and the courts don't get involved with that. And the conservatives seem to be articulating that view. I'll tell you, though, the conservatives did not articulate that view during the pandemic, when there were all sorts of laws that were requiring that you not congregate in large numbers, and they were challenged in many places as infringing on religious freedoms because people who wanted to gather for religious purposes were not able to do so. And this Supreme Court and these conservative justices reviewed those, even though those were based on public health determinations. They were the regulation of a public health concern, and they involved tens of thousands of people dying. This is about a state coming in and intervening with a family who has decided what's best for their kid with the consultation of their doctors, and Tennessee just decides categorically, no, we're going to ban this treatment, even though it doesn't harm anybody else. We're going to ban this treatment altogether. So our position is, yeah, medical decisions are generally left to doctors and sometimes to legislatures, but when the state draws a line based on sex, when it says you can get a medical treatment if it's consistent with your sex, you can't if it's inconsistent with your sex, just like if they said you can get a medical treatment if it's consistent with your race, but not if it's inconsistent with your race, we would see that as a race baseline. This is a sex baseline, and courts have a lot of experience subjecting sex baselines to heightened scrutiny.
By the way, just one last question. Isn't it the Supreme Court justices' job to become experts in things that they're not already experts in? Isn't that why they're on the highest court of the land? I mean, they don't use that excuse when they're talking about some arcane energy regulation or criminal law or abortion law. You know, there it's okay, to your point, to be experts. But in this one area, they say, well, we're not experts, so we can't deal with it.
Well, exactly. And just last year, the court issued a decision, very controversial decision, in which it said, we refuse as courts to defer to the agencies, the, you know, the energy department, you know, on questions that are critically, you know, based on science and expertise and the like. No, they're not any better than we are to make those decisions. So it was a kind of selective disquiet that the conservative justices were articulating. You know, we hope Justice Gorsuch didn't say a word. Justice Gorsuch ruled for transgender plaintiffs in a case that we did a few years ago on behalf of a transgender woman who was fired for being transgender, and he ruled that that is sex discrimination under Title VII. So we hope that he's a vote in our favor, and then one of the conservative justices comes over to our side once they, you know, go back and read the papers more closely. And because I think it's really it would be pretty extraordinary for the court to say a law that on its face says you can do something if it's consistent with sex, but you can't do it if it's inconsistent with sex, is actually not a sex-based law. It is by definition a sex-based law.
And Professor, I just want to point out, you mentioned this before we went on. How many times did you actually argue before the U.S. Supreme Court?
So I think it's 8 times. It could be 9. I've slightly lost count here, but that's a pretty good number for someone who's never represented the United States government. There are people who've argued, 100 cases before the court. They generally tend to represent the United States, which gets before the court pretty regularly. But it's been a privilege to do it at every stage. And and I was, I felt privileged to be representing the transgender kids and their families in this case. I didn't argue this case. My colleague, Chase Strangio from the ACLU, argued it. He was the first transgender lawyer to argue in the Supreme Court on the first case to address the constitutionality of a transgender restriction. So it was a historic day in the court, and I'm, hopeful that the questioning, does not indicate that we will prevail, we will lose. But if we do, this fight will go on, and I have no doubt that in the long term, people will recognize that we have to tolerate people who are transgender, just like we learned that we have to tolerate people who are LGBT, just like we learned that we have to tolerate people of different races, just like we learned that we have to tolerate people of different ethnicities and nationalities. It's part of who we are. It's difficult in the sort of transitional periods, but history is on our side.
Well, we really appreciate you joining us today on Legal Face Off. Thank you very much, Professor David Cole from Georgetown Law.
Thank you.
Nine. Welcome back to Legal Face Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. Jill Barton is a professor and legal writing director at University of Miami Law School and the author of The Supreme Guide to Writing, which came out in the fall and is available on hardcover, paperback, and ebook for all of your holiday shopping needs. Professor Barton, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Professor, your latest book provides tips on legal writing style and grammar rules and details your five-year look at the evolution of SCOTUS opinions over the years. Tell us more about what inspired you to write this book and what it's about.
Well, before I was a lawyer, I was a journalist for about 10 years. And in journalism, anytime you have any kind of grammar or writing style question, you could look to the AP style book, the Associated Press style book. And it's the writing Bible for journalists, and you can really trust it. And so when I transitioned to the law, that wasn't going to work for me anymore. And I realized that lawyers don't have a single definitive guide like that. And there's just a lot of issues that come up with the fact that we have all these guides that put out these rigid rules that often are wrong. And so one example that really drove that home for me was this case in Maine over a missing serial comma. You might have heard of it. It led to a $5 million settlement and years of litigation. And, you know, that is an example of where there was a problem because Maine lawmakers were following the legislative drafting manual that cited seven other writing guides and said you should not use the serial comma. It's also known as the Oxford comma or the comma in a series. And that was enough to create some ambiguity that led to the litigation. And so as a law professor, that's really frustrating, right? I want to teach my students how to write clearly and correctly. And so often the so-called rules for writing are up for debate. And so I just started looking at Supreme Court opinions for guidance. And over, I noticed that the justices, for example, use the serial comma. And so I just started looking at, you know, how does Chief Justice Roberts treat this question? How does Elena Kagan treat this question? And that project, that turned into a five-year study of 10,000 pages of Supreme Court opinions. And I discovered overall that the justices' writing is really progressive, surprisingly modern and even liberal, which is interesting given the conservative bent of the court. And so the book is the culmination of that five-year study. It's a guide for all legal writers. It shows when we should stick to a rule. It also shows when there should be some flexibility because sometimes the justices, some of them adhere to one rule and some of them don't. And so by following the court's lead, their ultimate authority in all other things in the law, I thought we could follow them, their lead in this and write with more clarity and precision and be at least a little more confident that we're getting it right.
So the precision is important because I think that's something that's missing. And you know, maybe you could share with us a couple of the best practices that your research study revealed, because I think that people might think when at least looking at the title of your book, that they have to write and communicate as if they are trying to impress a Supreme Court justice. And that's, from my perspective, one of the problems with writing, right? You have to unteach, you know, years of law school and perhaps practice skills of people thinking they have to sound like a lawyer. And I've read lots of books, including, you know, by a famous one by a few Supreme Court justices, where they talk about just write simply. The best kind of writing is, you know, the simplest. So maybe you could give us a couple of practice tips that you revealed along those lines.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with your first practice. Thank you for, you know, queuing that up. Yeah, number one, use short sentences and short words. And so a big word does not make you sound smarter. The justices' sentences average just 20 words per sentence. And they really are masters at breaking down these complex legal issues that we all have to do, right? So consider a word like however versus a punchier word like but. We like to use these long conjunctions like however and nevertheless and nonetheless, but the justices use the word but seven times more than however. They start sentences with but and so 1,000 times or more a term. And they use those clunkier words like however and moreover just a few dozen times typically. And that really surprises a lot of legal writers because you think a word like accordingly and nonetheless makes us sound lawyerly, but it doesn't. We should use these smaller words. They get the point across more quickly and we're all busy, right? Another takeaway I think is that grammar rules aren't always rigid. You know, for example, the justices do use that serial comma that I mentioned earlier, but they really do break some old-fashioned grammar rules. They write casually and conversationally. Justice Gorsuch uses contractions a lot, but so do seven of the other justices, at least in moderation. And so that feels natural and conversational. They don't do it every single sentence, but they do that. Another, I think, really helpful writing takeaway is that the justices use really great transitions. They sometimes have these 50-page opinions, as you know, and they use these crisp and effective transitions to guide the reader through their reasoning, and that creates some kind of momentum and clarity. And these are really simple transitions, right? Not accordingly, but they'll say things like to begin with or for one thing. And they'll introduce examples with things like say or to name a few. And so they really do make simple choices whenever they can to get their point across. And they also inject some style. You know, Justice Kagan especially is known for her witty and pithy phrasing. And she can make, they all can make in many ways, dry points memorable, which is helpful, right? Because we have to read so much as lawyers. So it's nice to read something that's a little bit wittier and easier to understand.
So, Professor, as a professor, you obviously get the opportunity to work with, you know, the next generation of attorneys before they become attorneys. What are you seeing are some of the strengths and challenges in these types of writing skills, particularly among the more junior, soon-to-be attorneys?
Yeah, that is a great question, because the writing is the foundation, right, to success in the legal career in so many ways. And you know, with junior attorneys and my law students, they one strength that they have, I'll start with that, is that they are more willing to adapt, and we need to figure out how to adapt, especially with embracing technology that we can use for even simple things like grammar checking, but also collaborative editing and brainstorming, and that can make it more efficient. But as far as their challenges, I think so often junior attorneys will and law students will make things overly complicated. They often feel the need to prove their expertise, and that can make them write in a dense or maybe a technical way. And you know, as I said earlier, good legal writing isn't about sounding smart. It's about being clear and persuasive and concise. And those are lessons that I really do emphasize in the book, that you know, complexity is innate in the law, but it should not be in your sentences. I think a big challenge for all of us is just mastering a balance between being thorough and being concise. New attorneys, you know, can really overwhelm the reader. And so it just takes a lot of practice and patience on the part of those who are mentoring them to figure out how to get them to a place where they can write in a more concise and direct and a really plain spoken way.
Speaking of that, Professor, I haven't got through your entire book yet. It's an amazing book. But I wrote down, as we were speaking, a few of my top 10 lists of things never to write in a brief. And I want to get your opinion on them. You could feel free to agree or disagree. Are you ready?
I'm absolutely ready. I love this.
Speaking of totally useless words that add nothing, that I cross off. I try not to be so angry when I cross off, but sometimes I find it hard not to cross off and circle. You know the cross and circle?
Cross and circle.
All right. So number one of my top 10 most useless terms at this time.
Yeah, cut it.
Do you think any reader is ever going to question, are they talking about this time or some other time in the future? Unless they specify at this time, I wonder if Gorsuch is going to know what I'm saying. All right, cut it. All right, cut it or keep it. You ready for this one?
Cut it, yeah.
On this case, this case. Because do you think any reader has ever wondered, I wonder if the writer is talking about this case that has a big caption with the case name or some other case. Are they just trying to confuse me by talking about some other case, even though they put Smith versus Jones in the caption?
Yeah, absolutely. Cut it.
Cut it or keep it. Cut it. All right. Here's another one. Cut it or keep it. I know the answer. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Please be advised.
Oh, no. Yes, we have to cut that.
Please be advised, because if you didn't say please be advised, they wouldn't know what you're saying. You know, hey, Ryan, please be advised. I would like you to pass me some salts. Thank God you said to please be advised. Right. All right. That's a cut it. My last one. And this is my favorite. You ready?
I'm absolutely
cut it or
ready.
Keep it. It's our new. It's everyone's favorite new game show. Cut it or keep it. Please see Exhibit A attached hereto and made a part hereof.
Oh, these words here too, here of, here too for, we should never use them.
Your ears. Because again, if you just said Exhibit A, they wouldn't know if it was made a part here of and made a part here. I mean, so I see that stuff every day. So your book is much needed, much required reading.
Thank you. Yeah, I call these wordy warm-ups, and I think we often use them to warm up to the point we want to make. And maybe it's a lack of confidence. Maybe we're not there yet. Maybe we're still thinking through what our point is going to be. But we use these placeholders that really serve no purpose too often.
Your last example, Rich, reminds me of when we spoke about it on one of our shows a few months ago about attached, please find.
Yes.
That's one of my, that's like the cousin of attached, please find.
Absolutely.
And Jill, being an award-winning journalist, you know that we deal with this on the media side as well. In the news tonight, well, of course, it's the news tonight. That's why we're doing it. Fled on foot, phrases that you might hear in the media, we try to work out. So I appreciate what you're doing on the legal side, and I'm sure on the journalistic side. So thank you very much for coming on with us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Yeah, and I think these lessons could apply to journalists and writers of all sorts, right? Because good writing translates to all genres.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We have the pleasure of being joined once again by Matthew Liller of KPM Law, also in Eastern Time Zone. Matthew, are you in Virginia or West Virginia today?
I am in Virginia.
All right. We've got Jay Gates.
By the way, Matt Liller, not Matt Lillard from Scream fame.
And Scooby-Doo fame.
That's right.
Did I say Lillard?
No, you said it right. It's just, you know, when I, for about a year into my relationship with Matt, I thought for sure he was busy making Scream 8.
Okay. And we have Jay Gates, Managing Director at Gallagher in beautiful Lincoln, Nebraska. Thank you guys both for coming on. Well, no Trump watch today, but we've got a couple breaking stories. We've got the Penny case out of New York. We've got the United Healthcare CEO. Rich, how do you want to navigate these two stories?
I mean, the Penny case we've been following, you know, that's the ex-Marine who put a chokehold on the individual in the subway that ultimately led to his death, although, you know, one of their defenses was that he had a pre-existing condition and this chokehold did not relate to his death. But on Friday, the big news was that the judge basically cut out the more serious charge of the two, manslaughter. And today, the jury, after only an hour of deliberations, I think they deliberated for 20 hours that resulted in the deadlock on Friday. Today, after I think only an hour of deliberation, they exonerated him. They found him not guilty of the lesser charge of basically negligence. Setting him free. So, of course, you know, lots of discussion about that, lots of racial accusations that this, you know, was at least partially resulting from the fact that the victim was black and the individual who was exonerated was white. And then, of course, we're all following the arrest of, they're still calling him a person of interest. He seems to be the suspect in the murder of the CEO on the streets of New York last week. You know, we talked offline about how this seemed to be a very thoughtful and deliberate crime. You know, in order to know exactly where the CEO was walking, Tina, he had to really plot out his whereabouts, presumably. On the other hand, he wasn't smart enough to, let's see, not lower his mask because he was flirted with at a hostel. He was not smart enough to not eat lunch at a McDonald's, one of the most public places you can be. I don't know, maybe use a drive-through, you know, if you're eating and not just linger in an Altoona PA McDonald's. So lots of theories out there. I know you have an interesting theory that you've heard, but, you know, tragic case, obviously, but good to see some good police work resulted in presumably the detention arrest of the suspect.
Yeah. So taking that case, Rich, it is horribly tragic. I mean, to hear something that somebody is shot in cold blood, essentially in the middle of Midtown, you know, first thing in the morning on his way to, I think he was on his way to a conference. It's just shocking. I mean, I know when I go to New York, I'm in Midtown all the time. And the whole thought that this happens in the middle of the day in broad daylight, is shocking. One of the theories that I heard, and I think they're still investigating this, so I'm not sure that this is even a viable theory, but someone said on CNN that, you know, one of the things that they, that authorities may be investigating is the possibility that the person, the person who, the victim actually had, conspired with the killer to have him killed for insurance purposes. So, I mean, it sounds pretty outlandish, but it was something that was mentioned in the context of interviews about this shooting. So I guess we'll see, Rich, in the coming days. But a lot of lot of breaking news the last few days.
Jay, in the course of 10 years of doing this show, we've covered lots of stories, lots of criminal stories, and lots of dumb criminals. There's some theories out there from some experts that this individual wanted to be caught. And, you know, at first glance, you know, who knows? But it's hard to be a fugitive from justice, presumably, that almost the entire country is looking for in some respects, right? There's not many people who haven't heard of the story and who hasn't seen the various pictures of this individual. So perhaps he just ran out of will and energy to flee and was sort of giving up by going to that McDonald's. What do you think?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yeah. It really makes no sense, especially, you know, as a criminal, it sounds like he planned this thing and did a pretty good job of executing his plan and getting away and wearing his mask and all that. And then to sit down and be eating an Egg McMuffin, I mean, not that far away. I mean, that sounds like maybe he was just tired of the run or wanted to get caught. Absolutely.
Matt, let's turn to the Penny case quickly. I mean, New York City, you know, pretty liberal city historically, but we saw in the last election that there's a bit of a tide turning, perhaps. What are your thoughts on what the jury did with this high profile case?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's not terribly difficult to think about New York and think about, you know, odd ducks that may be on public transportation. And so it's certainly not difficult to see this playing out. But you know, the criminal jury results are one thing, but I think there's already a civil suit filed or obviously forthcoming. And so the facts of this case and the circumstances of this case are certainly going to come full circle again in the context of a civil case. And so it'll be interesting kind of two steps down the road to see how it comes out the second time.
Yeah, different standard there, of course, in a civil versus a criminal case.
All right, moving along, the band Kiss is getting sued and could go to court, and Rich is going to explain why and what a wig roadie is.
Yeah, that was a first for me. Not a bad gig, perhaps, being a wig roadie. But yeah, there's a lawsuit that's in the news in L.A., of course. A judge told the band Kiss to settle or consider selling this court case. This is a claim brought last year by a former crew member, the wig roadie in question, who claims that he was mistreated on tour and wrongfully terminated after being with the band for 30 years. His main responsibility, Tina, was to maintain the band's hair, something I can't really relate to, but I guess is a thing when you're dealing with rock bands. But he said his main allegation that he was forced to work closely with Gene Simmons, who is the not star child, but he is the demon, of course, in Kiss, and that he was exposed to COVID as a result. The counter to that, the defendants argued that he wasn't an employee. The main, you know, main response that he was an independent contractor. The judge had some skepticism about that. He said, if he's with you for 30 years taking care of your hair, he's probably an employee. And my favorite part of what the judge said, by the way, is that here's the quote from the judge. You ready for this piece of legal wisdom? You might want to slow down when you listen to this because it's hard to follow. If this goes to trial, it would not surprise me if Mr. Matthews got nothing. It would not surprise me if he made a big pot of money. Oh, really? Okay, wow. Way to really go out on a limb there, Judge. So you're telling me, slow down, that he could either win or lose. Wow, that's amazing. Thanks for the newsflash. But yeah, Tina, have you ever worked as a wig roadie? And do you think that they should be exposed to COVID? And also, by the way, the judge said that they're wearing, like, they're the only band that wears makeup, so they shouldn't have to wear masks, right?
Yeah, because the masks, like, yeah, he was saying that that's a pretty nonsensical argument, because if the plaintiff's suggesting that they should wear masks to curb the spread of COVID, that would mess up their makeup, and then Kiss wouldn't be Kiss without their makeup perfect, right? So Yeah, no, I thought it was actually a pretty funny story. I would love to be a wig roadie for Poison. Talk about another band that I think there's probably many a wig roadie that has been made a millionaire by touring with that band over the years.
Every wig has its thorn. Matt, speaking of hair, speaking of, I mean, we're going to skip Jay for this story only because Jay and I can't really comment on this issue. But Matt, let's take a side look at that salad you have going up top. Look at this thing. It has a life of its own. We don't want to undo it because it will cover the camera. But tell us about the merits of this hairy suit, hair-raising suit.
Well, as now a newfound man of hair, about a year and a half in, I shaved my head for many years, but I've gone to the other side here, so I have a soft spot for hair maintenance right now. You know, the first thing that pops out to me about this is, you know, the headline of the judge urging everybody to settle. You know, as civil litigators, you know, we want to try cases and you know, our clients have these deep-rooted positions about, you know, the dastardly positions of the other side and how, you know, how favorable our positions may be. And we want to march into the courtroom and we want to try our case. But then it seems like every judge is doing everything in the judge's possibility to discourage everybody from trying a case. And so, you know, it's interesting, you know, Rich, to your point, it's like, well, the judge says, well, you know, Mr. Plaintiff, you may either win or you could lose. And it's like, well, we kind of inherently all know that. We kind of inherently all know that the plaintiff may get nothing or the plaintiff may walk away with a big pot of money. But it's just, it's interesting that, you know, I'm in Virginia and practice in Virginia and West Virginia. It's interesting that it's like a paramount thing everywhere that judges seems like that they would rather the parties not try cases and just settle cases.
Yeah. And Jay, we're going to move on from this story, but you know, the most disturbing and frankly sickening thing that Matt said in this whole piece was that he chose to shave his head and now he's on the opposite end. Look how much hair he has. Hey, newsflash, we can't all choose to have this look, Liller. So way to rub it in, man. I see what you're doing there. I see what you did. I don't like it.
There might be a new opportunity for some sponsorships from Restore Hair or something.
Perhaps.
All right. Well, a singer of the Village People says there's nothing gay about the song YMCA. And if you call it that, he'll sue you.
Tina, everyone's got to do the Trump, though, as we play that song.
This is true. This is
oh, my God.
It's on the playlist.
Yes.
Young
so,
man.
Ryan, yes, last week, the Village People singer and songwriter Victor Willis said in a social media post that he's had about enough of people claiming that the 1970s smash hit YMCA is a gay anthem and that it's simply not true that it was a song aimed at the gay community. And he started to threaten gay anybody in the news outlets who say that it's a gay anthem and that while he finds the description defamatory and damaging to the song if it comes from news outlets, he's okay with the gay community thinking of the song as their anthem. But he did warn those news outlets that are out there reporting that it's the gay anthem that what that really means is that they're saying that the song alludes to illicit activity and that come 2025, he's going to start suing them. He was pretty happy, though, that President-elect Donald Trump used the song at his campaign rallies. And he said that while some of the members of the Village People are gay, not all of them are. And that the album, which many critics who have listened to this album say that the album is about gay life. But Willis completely disagrees and says, no way, no how. I mean, I think one of the most compelling pieces of evidence here, Rich, is that the video for the song was filmed at the very famous Ramrod Bar, which is a gay bar in New York City. What Willis also seems to forget, Rich, is that there are little things called the First Amendment, where there are special rules relating to news outlets and news reporting, which is probably going to make it pretty difficult for him to succeed against the media. And by the way, people have been saying this now for, I don't know, 40 years. So I think it's going to be pretty tough to put the genie back in the bottle on this one, Rich.
Let's break the story down a little. First of all, look at the lyrics of YMCA. Are you ready? In the Trump words, like, are you ready for this?
Do you need to look it up? Seriously, young man?
Wait a second. There's a place you can go. Many ways to have a good time. They have everything for young men to enjoy. You can hang out with all the boys. It's gay. It's very, very gay.
We're saying this in 2024, by the way. So Rich has a little bit of like a month to go. Yeah.
No, but it's okay.
Like 50 years.
It's okay. It's a great gay song. It's gay. But listen, you know what some other songs on the album are called? Sodom and Gomorrah, Key West, which is a well-known gay resort, Just a Gigolo, I Am What I Am. Other titles from this band include, on the same album, I'm a Cruiser, and Hot Cop. But no, it's not gay. You're right. I mean, just embrace it. It's fine. It's, I mean, you know, it's, and by the way, the other, yeah, I took a deep dive into a bunch of stories on this question, and my conclusion is it's gay. Jay.
My thought is, I don't know whether it's gay or not, but I know in the last 40 years, he's probably made a lot of money.
Right.
And I wouldn't be worrying about it. I mean, who cares? Whatever it is, it's made him a tremendous amount of money on that song alone. He suing people is not the way to go.
That's right. You know how many songs there are about places you can go, Matt, that aren't gay? This is a song about a place you could go. Which is great, because it's the rarities that make the money, not the common song. But Matt, gay or not gay?
I think it's very gay. And that's okay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
Great song.
No, not at all.
I think you'd be even more disappointed if he said we couldn't do the hand gestures with the song anymore. That would be, they started suing baseball stadiums for playing it. That would be a little bit different of a story. All right. Keep going, Ridge. Keep dancing. All right. Let's move on here. OJ Simpson's
I'll do it. Can everyone do it?
There you go. See? OJ Simpson's former bodyguard says OJ confessed a murder in a recording, but Tina, the LAPD, says not so fast.
Speaking of gay songs.
No. So, Ryan, yes. TMZ actually broke this story last week that OJ Simpson's former bodyguard, Ira Cavelli, claimed he had a thumb drive recording in a backpack with OJ confessing to the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. So this story starts actually a couple of years ago when the Bloomington, Minnesota Police Department arrested Avelli on assault charges. They confiscated this backpack. There were a number of thumb drives in it, including the one that Avelli said had this confession. This past June, Bloomington police were contacted by the LAPD after Avelli and his attorney were looking for the thumb drive with the alleged confession. And Avelli actually filed suit against the Bloomington, Minnesota PD, demanding that the thumb drives be returned. That request was denied. The Bloomington police ran a forensics analysis on the drives and did not find anything resembling a bombshell confession, nor is there any information at all that talked about O.J. Simpson. Apparently, only Avelli's voice was on these recordings. And so the conclusion was, Rich, that there was absolutely no evidentiary value to this thumb drive. Just when we thought that we could bring some more OJ news back onto Legal Face-Off, this has been thwarted, apparently.
Even in death, the juice continues to waste all of our time with the question of whether he did it. I guess writing a book 20 years ago saying, if I did it, I didn't really do it, but if I did it, here's exactly how I would have gone about it. That wasn't enough. But yeah, Juice, you did it. We know it. Goodbye. Go back to hell. Matt?
I'm going to echo the so what sentiment that Jay shared on the last one as far as the YMCA being whether or not it's a gay anthem. I will say, so what if there is a purported audio recording? It's kind of, perhaps one of the worst kept secrets in American history.
Jay, you want to take the opposite? I mean, this is called Legal Face-Off. Can you take the opposite view that this was neither a confession? It was one of the confession because OJ had nothing to confess to. Jay?
I'm not going to defend OJ Simpson if that's what you're asking me to do. That's been decided in a court of law. What I will say is he's dead. So who cares? I mean, who cares? He's dead and it's over.
I mean, he still has kids, right? Didn't he have, he had two boys?
Boy and a girl.
boy and a girl. I don't know what's left or what they owe or how they're tied at all, but I guess this saga is never going to end. As long as you lived in the 90s, you're always going to be interested in this one form or another. Rich, Lizzo chalked up a big win after being sued by her hairstylist. You seem to be on a hair kick here.
These hairstylist stories, they don't stop. Dangerous to be a hairstylist. Yeah, we covered the story initially on Friday of last week in federal court. The judge dismissed at least part of this lawsuit. There was, I think, 7 causes of action. They dismissed the ones that were personally against Lizzo. The plaintiff is alleging that she was harassed sexually and basically abused by Lizzo. But the court ruled that she had no standing to sue Lizzo individually because she wasn't her employer. So, you know, high profile case, Tina, but really, you know, the ruling here was not unexpected. Generally, especially high profile individuals like, you know, Lizzo would not expose themselves to personal liability. That's what they have, you know, corporations and production companies, et cetera, for.
Absolutely, Rich. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with this case, if it continues to move forward or if they find a way to settle it out of court. But, you know, my guess is that the plaintiff is looking for sensationalism, right? And so while the case is still going on, the wind isn't quite as much in their sails as it was before. So we'll see what happens with this one.
Jay, interestingly, the lawsuit against the production company continues. And interestingly, the name of that company is Big Girl Touring, and girl is spelled G-R-R-L. By the way, we had a guest on earlier about legal writing. That's terrible legal writing, misspelling girl that way. But I wonder if Big Girl Touring could just, you know, disband and come back with Big Girl Touring, you know, 4 R's, and then avoid liability by just keep adding another R as they continue to be sued. What do you think?
Maybe. I'm not a lawyer, so once again, I don't know if they could change the name, but it sounded like the allegations originally in the original letter when that story first broke were pretty nasty and egregious if proven true. So the fact that she didn't have standing to sue Lizzo herself, but go after the company, I mean, at some point she may want to consider settling just to keep all that nastiness out of the media, because I think it ultimately cost her a shot at maybe doing the Super Bowl when she was super, super hot. So, I mean, I'd settle it and get it over with.
Yeah, the accusations were that they would call performers fat, useless, dumb, force them to change in front of mostly white men who would gawk at them. So serious allegations for sure.
All right, moving along. There are children within earshot. So, Rich, I'll just tee you up on this one, okay? A man who suffered, let's just say, unnecessary injections is getting $400 million.
Yes. I mean, this is notable, not just because, you know, on this show we are lewd and lascivious, but really, legally speaking, it's a noteworthy case because he was awarded the biggest ever medical malpractice payout. Now, you got to say that. You got to really think about that because we've covered and there have been some notable, you know, massive medical malpractice payouts. This one is $412 million, Tina, which, you know, frequently these cases are lowered on appeal because judges find these jury awards to be contrary to, you know, public interest. But right now that jury verdict stands, and the allegation from this man who was in his 70s said that he was seeking treatment for fatigue and weight loss, but this clinic named New Mail Medical Center, that's a nationwide clinic that touts itself as a men's health clinic, they operate in several states, they said that they were pushing penile injections that were, you know, not trustworthy. This miracle cure for erectile dysfunction left this plaintiff permanently damaged, robbing him of his ability to, you know, share intimacy. This place has clinics, like I said, in about 7 or 8 states. There was also another trial that was held in Albuquerque earlier this month. So, pretty massive verdict. We'll see if it's upheld on appeal.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, as you said, oftentimes on appeal, these verdicts come down. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, usually they'll stick if there was some really egregious behavior on the part of the defendant. Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty serious thing. I mean, if the allegations are true and you've got, you know, a decision already that the allegations are true enough to give him such a huge reward or huge award, we'll see. But I don't know. I usually don't talk about these kinds of decisions involving the male anatomy. Maybe Matt and Jay can comment.
Matt, I'm going to turn to you.
Well, if you peruse the New Mail website, they've got several treatments listed that they are known for, about half of which that I can see involve penile injections. So it seems to be perhaps one of those situations like, you know, if all you have is a hammer, all your problems look like they need penile injections. And so maybe that's where that came from.
My God, Jay. Hang on. I got to ask you this question, because the name of the injection, you can't make this up. The name of the injection is a medically effective compound, allegedly, and it's called Trimix. Do you really want to use the word trim when you're discussing that very sensitive part of the male anatomy? Unless they're newborns, I would stay away from the word trim anytime you're injecting something into the male glandular area.
I would not use that name. I can't, to Tina's point, during my days of workers' comp, there were just a few cases that I came across where the male body parts were affected by injury, and there were some unique treatments to try and get them back online, and loss of consortium and those kind of things from a workers' comp standpoint. But no, this here, I mean, 70 years old, 40 million, no more pleasure. You know, that's a rough go, no matter how you slice it. The 400 million is still not going to help you out.
Guy was 70. What is he doing? 400 million. Was he having that much sex? Was he really? And by the way, speaking of loss of consortium, whenever I depose, and Matt will back me up, whenever you depose someone who's alleging loss of consortium, which for our listeners means that you basically can't have sex anymore, you look at these people, and these people are alleging that before their injury, they were the most sexually active people, you know, in the world, and now they can't have sex. I'm looking at them across this conference room. I'm like, you? Really? Look in the mirror, buddy. You haven't even seen your privates in like 20 years, let alone had sex using them. So anyway, by the way, that story brought to us from our former producer, Emily Flores. And big shout out to Emily for bringing this really compelling story to our attention.
I like Matt's perspective of these guys just sitting around going, how do we fix this? I know. Injection. Let's do it. All right, let's wrap things up. Can the legal system protect a person's vibe? Tina, you've got a story about an, I love this, Amazon minimalist influencer.
First of its kind lawsuit, with one Amazon influencer suing another for what she says is the copying of her vibe, her neutral beige and cream aesthetic. Sydney Nicole Gifford claims that fellow influencer Alyssa Scheil has copied her vibe, including everything from the fonts on her social media to the camera angles that she uses to take pictures, to making her apartment look just like hers, to getting her hair cut and getting it dyed so that it looks very similar to hers, as well as featuring similar Amazon products on her social media. And she claims all of this happened only after the two of them met a while back to discuss a potential collaboration. For those of you who don't know who influencers are, we talk about them a lot here on Legal Face Off. These folks can make a ton of money. They make a career out of recommending certain products, this time from Amazon, and demonstrating those products on their social media. They earn a commission, and if they sell enough, they can make a hefty amount of money. So Gifford claims that Scheil did so much mimicking of her vibe that consumers actually started getting confused and were having a hard time telling them apart. And then it actually started cutting into the money she was making on commission. And at one point, she was making half of the commission that she usually made. Her complaint actually, Rich, has nearly 70 pages of side-by-side comparisons, some of which are a bit compelling, but some of which are, I think, nonsense. For example, she posted, she showed two side-by-side photos of her modeling earrings, sweeping her hair back as she did it. And she said Scheil did the same thing. It was a nearly identical pair of earrings, nearly identical pose. I mean, this is what girls do when they are showing off new earrings. So I really, I mean, and there's quite a bit of that going on in this lawsuit.
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, some of it's a bit compelling, but there's a lot of it that looks like this, like taking shots from a similar angle, using beige, and, you know, selling the same things on Amazon. I mean, Amazon has a ton of influencers that are all trying to do the same thing. They're all trying to make money. But Gifford actually, after sending demand letters that went unanswered, she sued under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and she's actually seeking up to $150,000 in damages for mental anguish and lost income, Rich.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there's going to be a lot of similarities between influencers. There's no question. But, you know, this one does have some, I think, viability to it. When you look at, you know, the side-by-side comparison of some of the pictures and just some of the angles. So I think, you know, I think this would, I mean, we look at things in litigation frequently, like would it get to a jury? Would it survive a summary judgment motion? I think there's enough there to survive a summary judgment motion. Whether a jury would be convinced, who knows? But this is the new, obviously this is, you know, the way things are going to be, and not the first or not the last time I think we'll see influencers claiming this, but maybe the first time. Matt, as an influencer yourself, hang on, we're going to look at this side by side here. Let's get a mini. All right, so here's Gifford on the left, Scheel on the right. I mean, is this enough? There's 9 photos she's standing in front of versus 6. I don't know. That one seems fairly generic. What else we got?
There's also a very similar, I think, bicep flower tattoo between the two of them as well.
Yeah.
Similar, but they're not the same. And I'd have to say, as an intellectual property attorney, it's really hard to assert something like copyright infringement for this, because with copyright infringement, as our listeners know from all the stories we've covered over the years, sometimes you really, in order to succeed, you have to come really close. You essentially have to be copying. And this whole notion of getting a vibe or someone, you know, evoking a similar feel does not necessarily trigger an infringement.
Yeah. And you know, I spent a lot of time on the YouTube space, and, you know, it's kind of one of the things that they tell new creators is, you know, kind of emulate, you know, those ahead of you that you enjoy. And so it seems like a pretty uphill battle for me for one, you know, creator to prevail claims over another creator for a similar type of vibe or reviewing similar types of products, or having a similar color palette in their studio. It just seems pretty uphill to me.
The problem is, Jay, legally, we try to be definite. We try to work with terms we understand. What the F is a vibe? How are you supposed to define an aesthetic or a vibe? It's like when I ask my daughter, if she's seeing someone, she says, well, we're talking. Remember when talking used to mean that you're actually speaking words to someone? When did talking become a dating term? How do you define vibes? How are you going to convince a jury that it's the same vibe or aesthetic? Come on, stop it.
I don't know. This seems pretty frivolous to me. I think one of the ultimate influencers of all time, Kim Kardashian, who's made billions of dollars doing nothing. There's a million girls out there trying to look like Kim Kardashian and get into advertisers and all that kind of stuff. So the fact that this girl standing next to a palette of pictures on the wall is the same as another lady and she's trying to get 150 G's, that makes no sense to me. But it's not what I do on a day-to-day, so I'm okay with it.
All right, well, we'll let you out of here with this question. Talked about the 90s and OJ. I'm going to stump you guys. Name, we talked a lot about songs today. So you got to name your favorite vibe, your favorite song from the 1990s. Jay Gates, favorite song from the
90s. Clinton favorite era. Favorite song?
Absolutely.
Freak Me by Silk.
Whoa. All right. Well,
that takes me back to prom night. Sorry.
Good one. It's a good one. We don't want to hear what happened on your prom night, but I'm sure it went very well. Ryan Burrow, favorite 90s song?
We'll go Pearl Jam Black.
Pearl Jam Black. That's a good one. What year was that? 1993, maybe? No. Tina Martini. That's a good one. Favorite 90s song? This is when a young Tina Martini was just becoming aware of some big bands of the 90s. What's your favorite 90s song?
Well, when I think, like, my first thought was actually Lenny Kravitz. Mama Said, that album that came out as I was starting law school, that was a great album. That was quite a cool vibe in the early 90s. So it was when he was first starting out.
Good hair on Lenny Kravitz, like Matt Lillard.
Yes,
Matt Lillard.
It's all about the hair.
Matt Lillard, favorite hair or non-hair artist who sang a song in the 90s?
Well, I, of course, was a fan of the Spice Girls in the 90s, and Spice Girls Wannabe certainly shaped my middle school era.
Wow. Here's a story from A to Z. You want to get with me? You got to listen carefully. I'm going to go with, I got a lot of songs, you know, a lot of Springsteen songs, but you can't go wrong with a song that screams the 90s, like Chumbawamba. Tub Thumping. Remember Tub Thumping?
Yeah.
The ultimate one-hit wonder. It was a great song because there was like four different parts of it. Each of which could have been its own song, you know? But you're multidimensional.
I thought we were going to say the Macarena, Rich.
You thought we were going to say what?
Little bit of history on Chumbawamba. Actually, a big protest band. That was kind of a one-off goofy hit. But they
I take a whiskey drink. That guy drank a lot. He took a whiskey drink. He took a beer drink. Took a vodka drink.
Lager drink.
Lager
and then
drink.
The cider drink.
And then the cider. All right, Lisa. Favorite 90s song?
I got to go with Baby Got Back.
All right, this is by request. As we go out, by request of Tina Martini. Everyone do it. As Ryan signs us out.
Oh, the Macarena. There we go. Flashback to the 1996 Democratic National Convention for that one. All right. Thank you so much, Jay Gates and Matt Liller. That'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN, celebrating 10 years, doing the Macarena into the second decade. Special thanks to Margaret Love of the Law Office of Margaret Love. We had the University of Miami Law Professor Jill Barton on. She's the author of Supreme Guide to Writing. Go ahead and check that out. It's on Amazon. We've also got Professor David Cole of Georgetown Law. He's also the former ACLU legal director. And also shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stiegel. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff, I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...